Good morning, Life Journey Church.
Morning.
If we have not met before, my name is Chris Edwards. I'm the minister of family life here at Life Journey Church, and it is my pleasure to speak to you today. Today, the kids are talking about and exploring the writings of Solomon, David's 11th son, the son of King David, and Bathsheba. Bathsheba was the great sin and the great shame for King David. But he treasured his son Solomon nonetheless. Solomon was 20 years old, just barely older than a child when he took the throne. And he had taken the throne right after he just watched his older brother try to overthrow his father. He watched all this turmoil between the family. And he had a dream where God appeared to him and said, "Solomon, I will give you anything you want. You're about to become king. How can I give you a gift?" And after all he saw, it would have been really easy for him to ask for power because he just watched people snatch it, or a long life because he had just watched several of his brothers die in the conflict. It would have been so easy for him to ask for any of those things that we would normally think a king would ask for. But instead, he admitted his inability to be king and just said, "God, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm just a kid. I don't know how to do this. God, give me your wisdom." God loved that answer. The scriptures tell us that not only did God give Solomon wisdom to be the wisest man on earth that had ever lived or will ever live, but also added on to him money and power. He had it all. See, King David, we often think back to King David, and King David is the one that was after God's own heart. We treasure King David as the greatest king that ever lived for Israel. And in many ways he was. But King Solomon put Israel on the map. Took it from a tribal kingdom that was barely surviving to a kingdom that was making treaties with the largest known kingdoms like Egypt. Solomon put them on the map. Blessed him with all of those things, wealth, power. King Solomon shared the wisdom that he received in three books that we find in our scriptures: Proverbs, the Song of Solomon, and Ecclesiastes. Proverbs is a list of wise sayings that we can look to. Song of Solomon is a book of intimacy that shows something about the relationship between the members of the Trinity, as well as the relationship between the church in Christ. And then Ecclesiastes is the book that we're going to look at today, because while the kids will go over just a quick general overview of all three books, I figure one is enough for us. If you will, pray with me. God, thank you so much for the opportunity to study King Solomon, to learn from Solomon's wisdom. Help us to dig into the truth in your words. Help us to see how we can apply it this week. We love you. Amen. There was a boy who, he was struggling with math, and he slowly started to his grades dropped and dropped a little bit more until he was failing. And his parents noticed that as he started to fail, he really lost all of his motivations to even try. And they had heard about this Catholic school around the corner, a private Catholic school that had a really good reputation for getting things done. So in hopes that it would change his patterns, they signed him up, and he went to school. And after his first day of school, he came in, immediately ran upstairs, went into his bedroom, and slammed the door. They figured it must have been a bad day. Let's give him a little space. Hours go by, and he's still up there. Like, what's going on? What's happening? So they go in, and they peek in the door, only to find him at his desk, studiously working on his math work. Like, well, that's a nice change. So they let it go. The next day, he did the same thing. Ran upstairs, slammed the door, went in and studied. And the next day, the same. This carried on as a pattern for pretty much the whole year, until he brings his report card to his parents at the end of the school year, and he hands it to them. And they look over the grades, and they're pretty satisfied with everything until they get to the math. And they look at math, and next to math is A+. Wow. Like, What happened? They asked the boy. How did you go from barely even caring about math to the highest grades you have? What changed? And the boy looked at him and said, well, on my first day of school, I walked in. And there behind the teacher's desk, they had nailed a man to the cross. And I knew they meant business because he was on the plus sign and I had to do something. From this boy's perspective, this teacher meant business. And a teacher who's that serious gets results. They shock us into doing something different. And in Ecclesiastes, we have two main characters. There's an editor and there's a teacher. And the teacher in Ecclesiastes is the same kind of teacher. This is a teacher who means business. This is a teacher who wants to prompt you into an uncomfortable place so that action will follow. The editor, on the other hand, is there to introduce the text and simply say, you know, this person who's writing, the teacher, this is the son of King David, and this is the one who organized Proverbs. So we know that the teacher is Solomon. That's how we know who our teacher is in this section. The person who's the editor also gets the final word, and we'll talk about that at the end. If you've ever faced darkness, or if you've looked into the eyes in one in its embrace, you've heard the teacher's message before. It's something like this. There's nothing to anything. It's all smoke. A lifetime of work, it's like blowing in the wind. Meaningless. It's a dark message. It's a tough message to hear, but it's intended to prod you. Like the teacher with someone nailed to the plus sign in the back, it's going to prompt you into something new, a new action. The Hebrew word here, the core of Solomon's message, is hevel. It's used over 40 times throughout the scriptures in one way, or throughout this particular book, actually, in one way or another. In most English translations, it's translated into the word meaningless. But Solomon, the teacher, never told us that life is meaningless. That wasn't his message at all. Disorienting? Yeah. Confusing? Absolutely. The word hevel is something like smoke or vapor. It gives this idea that if you were to reach for it and grasp it, that it just dissipates. It's just slightly out of reach. It's something that you can never quite get. It's elusive. So when you read these verses, when you read through Ecclesiastes, you have to almost do a little bit of translation to start to think about it as disorienting or elusive rather than meaningless. Spencer and I were talking the other day, and we were having a philosophical conversation about life, just chit-chatting. And he asked this question. He said, why is it that people with power and people with money, they keep reaching for another thing, and then if they get it, they're reaching for another thing. They just never stop. What could the end game possibly be? Why would they do this? And I shouted out, Duca! And he looked at me about as strangely as some of you are right now. See, dukkha is a strange word. It's a word that we don't often talk about in the Christian world, but it is a word that's common in the Buddhist philosophy. And dukkha means reaching. It's this concept that we find the concept, we just don't find the word in Christianity. It means reaching, and it's like, if I reach out to grab something, and then whether I get it or whether I don't, my next thing is I'm reaching for another thing. And I keep reaching and reaching, and the Buddhist philosophy would say, life is suffering, and suffering comes from dukkha, or reaching. That was their idea. They would say that you can't be at peace when your attention is constantly elsewhere. We live this way, don't we? As children, we say, oh, I wish I could just stay up a little later, like those who are older. I would be happy if that could happen. And then we get there, we just wish we could sleep a little longer. Or when we're youth and we think, oh, I just wish I could be free to make my own decisions. Why don't I get to choose things for me? I want to be free. And then we get to make all of our own decisions, and we wish we could just be free like a teenager. Don't get confused, though, and think that this is a problem of the youth. We do this, too. We look for a new car. We look for a new house. We reach for a new job. We're always reaching. We're never in the moment. We never stop and pause to appreciate. This reaching goes all the way back to the very beginning. I want you to think about Adam and Eve. The very first thing that they did wrong was to eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And when they did that, they understood the possibility of evil. Something in them changed, and they felt fear, and they hid. And when God confronted them, God let them know what the consequence of that action would be and said, look, you're going to struggle from now on. Things are going to be hard. You're going to plow the ground, and it's not going to agree with you. It's going to be hard, and you're going to have to sweat and work. And if you understand this from the perspective of Hevel, from smoke, it's this idea that Adam and Eve, up to this point, had been walking through the Garden of Eden. And when they wanted to eat, they just picked it up, and they ate it. And suddenly they understand that tomorrow that bush might not have a strawberry on it. I better do something. And they started to feel fear. So they started to farm. Now, there's nothing wrong with farming. I'm just saying that farming, this idea of storing up for the future, it came from fear. And we never stopped. The farmer gathered enough to get through the week and then wanted to have more so they could get through the month because they were worried they might not have enough later. Then they worried about their community, and on it goes to answer Spencer's question of why do people with all the power and all the money keep going? What is the end game? There is no end game. They will keep reaching forever and ever. Our struggle, our suffering, it comes from this fear. It's at the very core of it. I implore you, though, if you lean in to try to solve this problem, you need to understand that courage is not the lack of fear, but the ability to face it. What that means for us is that fear is not the opposite of courage, because they have to coexist at the same time. The opposite of fear is love, and the scriptures tell us that God is love. Separation from God is what led to this fear to begin with. Fear led to our suffering. It's only in reconciliation with God that we'll ever find a solution to this problem. It's not just by bucking up and trying to be courage. It won't work. Dukkha, reaching. Hevel, smoke. Whatever you call it, it will always ask for more of you. The hunger is endless. The appetite, you'll never fill it. Solomon had three major points in Ecclesiastes to bring this home. His message is bleak, and I warn you about that, but if you'll bear with me, we'll get back to the hope of Christ. His first great message was this: you are just a blip in the great march of time. It'll take you over 100 years at over 100 miles an hour to reach the sun. A journey that takes sunlight just 8 minutes, just a little over. Voyager 1 has been traveling for over 40 years at over 1 million miles a day. And it's just barely reached the edge of our solar system. There are 500,000 people born or that die every single day, which you might think, that's a huge number. What a difference. How big we must be. Until you realize that there are 275 million stars that are born or die in the known universe every single day. We are tiny, slow-moving creatures in a great, vast universe. We try to make our name for ourselves. We try to be remembered. Some of us get there. Solomon, it's been 3,000 years since Solomon wrote these words, and we still remember and we are still talking about Solomon today. Solomon made a name for himself. He got to the top and looked back and said, it's all meaningless. In case you think Solomon, though, is just depressing, he's not the only one that got there. Ernest Hemingway. Ernest Hemingway had it all. At the end of his race, he looked back and he said it was meaningless. At age 25, he had sipped champagne a little bit in Paris. A little bit later, he's off in Africa doing a famous game hunt. Then he goes to the northwest of America and he goes on these famous grizzly hunts. By age 61, he had lived it all. Wine, partner, song. He had had a successful literary career. And he looked back on his life. And he said this, life is one, I won't say the word, thing after another. That was his reflection on life on the Sunday evening that he took his own life. This was the last message that Hemingway left for us. When he got to the end, when he got to the top, he said, it's meaningless. It's all meaningless. There's a book. It's called Hope for the Flowers. The cover of it's here. If you've never read this book, you need to. It's not quite a children's book, but it is the only book that's for children that attempts to tackle this dark topic. And it's good. Please read it if you haven't. The idea behind this book is there's a caterpillar named Stripe. And Stripe is on his journey of meaning to become a butterfly. And he takes us along with him to every step. In the very beginning, Stripe, much like us, is happy to live the simple life and enjoy the simple pleasures. But at some point, hevel hits him. Dukkha, reaching. And he wants to grasp after something more. And in his world, there's something called the Great Caterpillar Pillar. And it's this mound of caterpillars, one climbing on top of another, clamoring and striving to get to the top where there's some meaning. They don't know what the meaning is, but it must be good. There's so many that want to get there. And so he struggles and he strives and they climb on top of each other's backs and on top of each other's heads, pushing other people down so that they can get up. It should sound familiar. He eventually, after much striving and much pushing, he eventually does get to the top. In the book, this is the page where he gets to the top. And he has a realization. He shouts out, there's nothing here at all. It was answered by another, somebody that wanted to squash down that message. Quiet, fool! They'll hear you down at the pillar. They didn't want them to know. They were already there. They were already at the top. And they didn't want the people at the bottom to know, or it might go crumbling down, and all they had achieved would go with it. Stripe felt frozen to be so high, but not high at all. It really only looked good from the bottom. He climbed back down that pillar, discouraged at that point. And as he climbed down, he told every caterpillar he passed, there's nothing up there. It's empty, it's hevel, it's meaningless. Please stop. Climb back down with me. Some of them paused, some of them didn't. They just climbed and clamored and wrestled with each other to get to the top of nothing at all. When he got down after a little while, as often happens in our lives, when we're in a low place, somebody showed up to guide him. A butterfly arrived. And the butterfly communicated to Stripe and said, I'm a caterpillar who transformed into a butterfly. Unbelievable. What do you mean? How can there be a different nature in me? How could I possibly become that? And the butterfly went on to explain and said, look, I was the one who tried to climb the pillar with you. I was there with you. I know the struggle that you're in. We misread the internal call to get high by climbing. Instead, the way for us to get high is to fly, not climb. Stripe couldn't believe it. How is this possible? How can I become a butterfly? How can I fly? He didn't understand the nature within himself. And that became his journey. The advice that the butterfly offered him was this. You have to want to fly so much that you're willing to give up being a caterpillar. I'm telling you right now, there is a nature inside of you, something that is so different. Just like there is a difference between the caterpillar and the butterfly, there is something inside of you that is ready to fly. But you have to be ready to give up on something to get there. Stripe ended up finishing this journey. And the author asks a question at the end. You just see that Stripe has turned into a butterfly, but also asks, is it the end? Is it just the beginning? We have to ask ourselves that same question as we go on the journey to find whatever nature it is that's inside of us that God has placed there. May, like Stripe, we learn that we are indeed meant to fly, but only by first giving up on the empty promise of greatness. Solomon's second message. They don't get better, y'all. Death is the great equalizer. My darkest encounter with a teacher was deep in the woods of North Carolina. I held a child in my arms with love, but not in a loving embrace. We struggled and we wrestled with each other as he grasped for anything he could get his hands on that was sharp. Sticks, glass, nails that had been thrown off, anything he could get that he could use to cut into his skin. Desperation filled his eyes as he made that reach, and he looked towards death as the great equalizer. We cried together as he struggled to end it, and I struggled to continue his life for just a little longer on this earth. The pressure to meet expectations had been piled on him by his parents. They had smothered him and crushed him. He understood something of Solomon's wisdom in Ecclesiastes. See, Solomon had looked from the top of the pillar, and he looked down at the world from the very top, and he understood that in death, it would be the great equalizer. He would be no better than those who had come before him, despite his great effort and great success. The boy I held that day, he looked up from the bottom of the pillar, and he came to the same realization. In death, there's no difference between me and those who have strived. In death, I won't have to face these expectations anymore. Solomon's third great lesson. Life is unpredictable. Good, bad, it's all a wash. What are we supposed to do with it? Stanley Kubrick, he studied in his filmmaking the depth of darkness, and he had this to say. The very meaningless of life forces man to create his own meaning. The most terrifying fact about the universe is not that it's hostile, it's that it's indifferent. See, good things happen to good people. But good things also happen to bad people. It's hevel, it's confusing, it's disorienting. Bad things do indeed happen to bad people. But they also happen to good people. It's hevel, it's disorienting, it's smoke. It's not divine judgment. It's not. It's a part of this fallen world that we live in. For more on this, I encourage you to read Ecclesiastes, especially with the understanding that when you read the word meaningless, that it's more like smoke, just out of reach, something that dissipates or just goes out of your hand. But I want to move on from this dark place and take a step closer to hope. Before I do, I have one last thing in this area that I want to share with you. If you happen to be in a dark place right now, or if you find yourself in one in the future, I beg you to seek help. Talk to somebody. Talk to a friend. Talk to a pastor here. Reach out for help. Because I'll promise you this, that the darkness in this world, these dark moments that we find ourselves in, they're just that. They're moments. They're passing, and they're just as fleeting as smoke. If you can't reach out to one of us, call this number. If you need this number, it's in your bulletin. It's under the sermon notes. That's the last I'll say on that. So, what does Solomon possibly have to say to us? After he's completely depressed us and brought us down, does he have anything to offer? Or in his wisdom, is he just wallowing in his own despair? What I'd share with you first, actually, is that he was trying to come up with a solution when he discovered the third one. See, the world at his time had this bit of wisdom that we still preach today. It goes like this. If you're righteous, God will bless you. And if you're wicked, God will curse you. Now, Solomon lived in a place where it was far easier to follow the laws in the scriptures than it is for us today, surrounded by people who were trying to do the same thing. And they wrestled and struggled to be righteous so that God would bless them. So not only was he living into that wisdom, but he was judging over people, his subjects, who also were living into that wisdom. But what he discovered was that it didn't work. That those very people who were pushing and striving, it didn't change. Good things happened to some of them, bad things happened to some of them, and it didn't seem to matter how holy they were. It was irrelevant. It was smoke. It was meaningless. And so he added his third piece. He had to sit with this for a few years before he really understood and before he started to push into the wisdom of something new that prophets have been saying over and over again. When you look through the Old Testament, prophets were saying, this is not how things work. Good and bad, they visit the same. You have to accept the suffering. It's a part of it. Jesus came in and said the same thing to us, told us to expect suffering. This is a message that has been going on over and over again. And we have to accept that it's a little confusing, that it's smoke, that life will be disorienting. It's complex, and it's hard to get. So after Solomon had spent some time with us, he came up with two simple rules for life. The first one is this: learn wisdom and fear and obey the Lord. If you're paying attention, you realize that I just told you this won't work. Solomon admitted that and said, look, okay, I know I just said this won't work, but you have to do it anyway because it's the right thing to do. Do it because it's the right thing, not because it's a transactional thing, not because you'll get something out of it, but because it will please God. So he started with that. His second rule is where we start to see change, but it's deceptive because we look at it and we think, that's too simple. Simply stop grasping. How are we supposed to do that? We find ourselves, we grasp one thing after another. You may have heard this. There's a common saying that people love to say to people in those moments of darkness and hopelessness. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we will die. It may surprise you to find out that that came from Scripture. Ecclesiastes 8:15. Eat, drink, and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun. And in case, again, that you think that this is just Solomon in his despair, Paul said it too. Corinthians 15:32, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. My favorite one, as this has become popular culture, is this one. Eat and drink and be merry, for tomorrow we may diet. Okay, so to be honest, in both of these cases, the authors actually were saying this partially tongue-in-cheek. They immediately said it and then went on to correct it because it was partially right. It was a saying of their day that's still a saying today. But they realized that there was something slightly off with it. And so they attempted to counter this cultural idea with something else, something that was a little more nuanced. It wasn't enough to just be merry and then die, because it bought into this idea of Hevel, not being smoke, but being meaningless, that there was nothing to life, that there was no meaning. And so eat, drink, and be merry by itself isn't enough. See, Hevel, this idea of smoke and accepting it, it calls us into something special. It calls us into this idea that we have to enjoy this moment rather than reaching for another. You've heard you can't have just one potato chip. It's like that. You reach in, you grab for another, and depending on your situation, it may or may not have hit your mouth before with the other hand you're grabbing another one. There's something about these things where we just can't appreciate the one that's in our mouth because we're too busy focused on reaching for the next one. Sometimes it's hard to get your hand in that bag. Jordan Peterson is a Canadian psychologist, and he's a professor. And he worked with people in some of the darkest places you could possibly imagine. And he had this to say about how we work through our darkness. When existence reveals itself as existentially intolerable, thinking collapses on itself. In such situations, in the depths, it's noticing, not thinking, that does the trick. So I'm going to amend our phrase a little bit, to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow you die. Instead, I want you to think of it this way. Eat, drink, be merry, for our lives are in God's hands. The pleasure in this world is not meaningless, but it points to the heaven that Christ is preparing for us right now. The trick is you can't just keep reaching or you'll never appreciate the heaven that's in your hands. You have to notice the pleasure that's before you. It's already there. It's within reach, like Christ said of the kingdom of God. It's at hand. It's within reach. It's already here. In noticing, in slowing down, you'll find satisfaction. You'll cease reaching, and you'll stop suffering. Solomon had three specific ideas when it came to this. Three ways that we can work towards stopping the grasping. This is not the end of a practice, but a very beginning of it. A beginning of slowing down. His first point was this: enjoy friendship. When you're sitting across the table from another person, put your phone away. Look at the humanity and the interesting stories that this person has. They have lived things that you could never understand if you didn't take time to listen. And if you watch, if you spend time noticing, you may just see the divine across the table from you. His second was this: enjoy a good meal. Slow down. Taste your food. We shovel it into our face so fast as we move from one busy thing to another busy thing. We never take time to realize that we're shoving in the very same calories we keep saying we don't need. And we don't even taste it. We'll buy the best food because we think, oh, this will taste good, but we eat it so fast it doesn't even touch the taste buds. Slow down. Take a pause. The third is this: enjoy the sunshine. Do you even remember what it feels like to have the sun cross your face? It's hard to do this one. It's hard to pause. I remember my dog, I love her. She's a St. Bernard. She's long-haired. And sometimes it gets hot here in the middle of the summer. But I watched her this summer. She would go out, no matter how hot it was, and her first few minutes outside, she would go into the sunniest part of the lawn, and she would lay her large body out on the grass in the hottest spot as wide as she could so that she could catch as much of the sunlight as she could. She loved it. She wouldn't stay there too long because if it was hot, she would need to go cool off. But she took the time to notice. She took the time to enjoy it. She paused. I think we can learn something from that. When I worked with the kids in wilderness therapy, we had this policy called no FI. It meant no future information, which meant they would ask a question like any reasonable person would do. What are we going to have for lunch today? What are we going to do after we do this? And our response was always the same, no FI, no FI. That's all we would say to them. We were relentless. They hated it. Our minds love to wonder. They wonder to the past and they wonder to the future. They rarely wonder to the now. We have to rein it in to get to the now. We have to do that on purpose, with intention. By withholding future information, we forced our kids to live in the moment, something that's really hard for humans to do. And we watched it transform them over time. It had a powerful impact. This list from Solomon, these three things, they really are just the beginning of slowing down. They're just the beginning of noticing, like Jordan Peterson said. I want to practice noticing. I don't want you to leave here having not taken just a couple minutes to focus on something. So ushers a few minutes ago brought raisins, a little bowl of raisins. I want you to not eat them. I want you to take one and pass it down. And once you have your raisin, I want you to close your eyes and I want you to roll that raisin around in your fingers. I want you to feel the skin. I want you to feel the bumps. I want you to lift it up to your face and smell it. And take that in. See if you can smell what one raisin smells like. Now I want you to put it in your mouth, but don't eat it. Don't chew it. Don't bite on it. Put it in your mouth and roll it around. Notice the texture. Notice the bumps. Notice the flavor. But even without biting it, there's just a hint of something. Now, I want you to put your teeth on it, but don't bite it. Put pressure on the raisin. Squeeze on it just a little, but don't let your teeth go through. Feel the resistance. Now I want you to bite it, but I don't want you to bite all the way through. Feel your teeth go through the edge of it and see if you can notice the gritty feeling. There's just an ever so slightly gritty texture on the inside that's not on the outside. Now you can bite all the way through it. Notice the change in the flavor. And chew it once, twice, maybe three times, and then roll it around in your mouth again. Notice the change in texture. Notice the change in the flavor. You can keep doing that if you want, but you can also open your eyes. We used to do this with our kids. Again, it's one of these wilderness therapy exercises. We would eat one raisin for 10 minutes. We just did a very short version of that. But I'm telling you, having experienced this and having led people through it, if you spend 10 minutes eating a raisin, you will know things and notice things about raisins that are pleasing that you will have never noticed any other way. It is knowledge that you can only get through experience. You can never be taught or told. Pleasure is often that way. You cannot be told about pleasure. You have to experience pleasure. The editor closed. I told you there was an editor and a teacher. The editor closed Ecclesiastes by adding just a little bit to Solomon's wisdom. He felt bold enough to do that. And he said this, that you have to trust God and trust God's judgment. Because oftentimes part of what gets us stuck in this idea of hevel, of reaching and always trying to get something new, what gets us stuck there is we don't trust God to be the judge and we're trying to be the judge ourselves. He looked at this and he said, look, anything other than trusting God to be the judge is more grasping. It's more hevel. You have to trust in the end. You have to trust that God will come through, that justice will happen. So meaning is not found in reaching or grasping. but by letting go. Our caterpillar, Stripe, had to let go to find his new nature. We too have to let go to find and discover our new nature. When we trust in God to be our judge, or the judge, we're free to enjoy God's creation. We're free to live in the moment. We're free to experience pleasure in its fullness. Here's the thing. It's difficult to get stuck in hevel when you're enjoying the warmth of the sun across your face. Thank you for your time and attention.